My talk is about DNS. DNS is part of the plumbing of the internet, and because of its pervasive nature, it actually goes everywhere. It is one of the most widely used protocols, but it's also one of the least likely to be blocked. It provides location service, and because of the pervasive nature, it has been used for all kinds of other services as well, good or bad. And because DNS is so pervasive, systems can even communicate over DNS, even if they cannot communicate or do not want to communicate directly with an outside system, they can do so over DNS. For example, there exist SQL exploitation toolkits that will exfiltrate a database table by doing the equivalent of get host by name queries. So this way the database doesn't talk directly to the internet, but it sends it out over DNS. What else do I want to say? So this figure shows two scenarios where communication happens over DNS. One is data exfiltration, where a hijacked client sends query to a local DNS resolver, which then forwards it to an attacker-controlled DNS server. The other scenario is remote access, where an attacker on the outside maintains contact with a hijacked system inside an enterprise network. In both cases, the outbound DNS query streams are a good candidate for detection. So, what our work is about and what it is not about. It's not about detecting an individual query. For example, one query per day for www.example.com sends a zero and the other one sends a one. There's no way, reasonable way, that you could detect such activities. So instead of detecting an individual query, we try to impose a security policy that limits the amount of information that a client may send over DNS to a remote DNS server. In our case, we use a 4 kilobyte per day bound for clients and remote domains. We use lossless compression and other techniques to avoid introducing false negatives. And with this, we have approximately 1 to 2 alerts per week for enterprise scale networks. We think that's an acceptable alert rate. With this system, we deploy it at scale, and we find that in 230 billion lookups, it finds 59 confirmed DNS tunnels. So it works. In the remainder of my talk, there are 3 segments. The first segment, I will show examples of information that may be embedded in DNS queries. In all cases, the general scenario is a hijacked system on an intranet talking to a local DNS resolver, which forwards queries to an external DNS server. I will be ignoring the DNS replies for now, briefly return them at the end. So the examples that I give are examples. Our detector will also detect other forms of information embedding beyond the examples that I show. At 255 bytes per query, DNS query names are the most potent information transport channel for DNS queries. That's, of course, by design. It's supposed to transport queries efficiently. I show 2 examples of information embedded directly into query names. One is from the popular Iodine TCP/IP over DNS tunnel. The other one is from legitimate software that just uses it for some kind of service. There is an amazing number of services that use DNS. If you've ever looked at DNS traffic at scale, you will see all kinds of weird stuff happening. Paul Fixie has a paper about what DNS is not. So based on this kind of technology, this is all the tunnels that we actually detected. And the tunnels that we found were either Iodine or variants of it. However, you can also embed information in DNS queries in more obscure ways. So instead of putting it directly into the name, you can use a small codebook of names and send out queries for those names. And A0 could be two bits of 0, and A3 could be two bits of 1. Talking about bits per query here now, instead of bytes, hundreds of bytes, so this is really slow. But it works. You can actually send out more than several kilobytes per day over DNS in this way. It's just not verifiable for interactive traffic. Another possibility is DNS query types. There are, in theory, 65,000 and so on types, but IANA has defined only 79, and in practice only a few of those are used, so the real capacity of these channels is very, very limited. And finally, an example of a more potent timing, more potent channel, it's the DNS timing, query timing channel. We did some survey of what, with NetAlyzer, what actually you could expect for time resolution of DNS traffic, and based on this we come to an estimate of 10 milliseconds, which is on the conservative side. And well, given that you have 10 milliseconds of time resolution, you effectively have 100 time slots per second. So you can send 100 bits per second, or maybe more, if you can pack several queries in one time slot. And in fact, the timing channel for the data sets that we have that have time information is by far the most, the biggest source of alerts. So we're really trying to get those down. Okay, now that I have shown you some examples of information in DNS, I'm going to briefly talk about how we measure the information content and how we do this without introducing false positives, negatives. Excuse me. First, I will focus on query names because those are the easiest to explain. The easiest way to measure the information content of DNS query names is just to concatenate the whole lot together. You get this very long string, you measure all the information that is there, but unfortunately, the number of alerts that we would get would be too large. When I do this for a data set called IntLab, Industrial Lab, we would have 20 times the alert rate that we would receive after we apply our full detection procedure. So this is good, but it's too many, we're drowning in alerts. We can reduce the number of alerts by an order of magnitude by using data compression. The output length is at least as large as the amount of information in the data, so that's good. We don't introduce false negatives. It is less sensitive to the way that information is encoded, base 64, hexadecimal, or whatever. That is technically satisfying. We have to do a little bit of extra work to make sure that the compression is really reversible, but that's really easy. And so this is a first good step, but it's not enough for our purposes. We find that we can, that different compressors actually have different worst case behaviors, and so we can improve the result by applying several different lossless compressors and picking the smallest result from each of them. So basically you use a different compressor depending on whether you want to compress a solid or a liquid or a gas. You just use a different tool, they just have different characteristics. With this, we're getting very close to perfection, and as we get closer to perfection, the returns of improvement diminish as well. This is the final step in our toolkit. We notice that many DNS queries repeat. They repeat endlessly and repeat again. And so, given that DNS queries repeat at the granularity of entire names, we can help the compressors by pre-processing the data. And to that end, we replace the list, the sequence of names, by a sequence of indices into a table of distinct names. It's code points. We compress the table and the sequence of indices and end up with a slightly smaller result. So that improves the alert rate a little bit more. It works good for query names. It doesn't work so well for query timing or query types, because as I show next, those are symbols are already very small and there is not much that we can gain. So this is our combined detection procedure, a measurement procedure. We apply the same procedure separately to the DNS query names, we apply it separately to the DNS query types, and we apply it separately to the DNS query inter-arrival time intervals. And then we add up the result, and that's our measurement. To verify that our measurement actually works, we did four experiments. The first experiment was just running Iodine, the popular TCP over DNS tunnel, and sending a file over it. And we found that the amount of information measured was something like 11% over the amount of information that we actually sent. So the 11% is mostly overhead due to SSH, which was we were using over the tunnel, and the Iodine TCP IP overhead itself. For the other tunnels, we actually had to build our own, because there are no known tunnels that use timing or code books for names or query types. So these tunnels are sending bits per query, and so they're much slower, so I send smaller files. The first tunnel uses a codebook of 16 names. The second one uses a codebook of 16 time intervals, and the last one uses a codebook of 16 query types. In all cases, the measured amount of information is pretty close to the amount of that we sent, and of course, it's a little larger. With smaller number of bits per query, the number of queries goes up, and so you see some non-zero amounts of timing entropy showing up with these tunnels. Okay. The last section is about an exercise of elimination, where we eliminate mostly benign query traffic without introducing false negatives. First, I proudly present our data sets. There are six. The first three represent enterprise networks where you have a sensor that can see individual client queries. The second three are sensors on the outside of a network, on the perimeter or even further away. SIE, in particular, is a collection of DNS traffic that is donated by organizations all over the world. It is, however, strongly dominated by a single US-based ISP. As a first stage, we eliminate DNS queries that are not forwarded to a remote DNS server. And that's because the reply is cached in the local resolver. So for this, we need to model the local resolver caching algorithm a little, and we need, of course, the reply TTL information. And with that, we can eliminate a lot of queries. This is only possible with one of our six data sets. The other ones didn't have it, didn't have reply TTLs. Second, we eliminate what we call uninteresting queries, and those are queries for names that don't exist, or names that are reserved, or names that are our own organization, or names that are for organizations that we have a lot of communication with. If there is a lot of communication between organizations, you don't need to use DNS to send information. DNS is utterly painful, and there are better ways to do that. So, but this way, we reduce 45 million queries for a particular data set to just 2.1 million queries. Then we aggregate our queries by client and organization. We try to aggregate in such a way that we don't have overlap between organizations. So we use the Mozilla effective TLD list to distinguish between domain name hierarchies, and we use address ranges of 16, 24, or 48 to partition the IP4, IP6 address space PTR queries. We just try to avoid blaming more than one organization. Here's a stage that actually turns out to be really useful in our batch mode analysis. We have a real-time detector that works a slightly different way, but that produces similar results. Just not time to explain how that one works. So here, based on total numbers of distinct and unique queries, time intervals, query types, we make a coarse estimate of how much information could be in there. We use a worst-case estimate of Shannon entropy based on a uniform distribution over distinct names, distinct time intervals, distinct type query types. Plus, we add the length of the distinct query names and the distinct query types. So that's all the information that could possibly be in there if we didn't do all the compression, because that is a very time-consuming thing, and this is very quick. With this, we eliminate almost all of the queries, and we're now down to 267,000 queries and 46 suffixes. This is the procedure that I explained in the second, in the middle part of my talk, the compressor-based procedure. Here, we reduce, we eliminate all but 12 suffixes from consideration. And finally, we end up with 12 suffixes. We eliminate those domains that we have already seen before. And so we're left with only one. In this case, it was boingo.com, and that needs to be investigated whether this is benign or malign. We investigate each domain only once. The idea is that if it is malicious, we handle the incident, maybe do an IDS rule. If it's benign, we ignore it. If it becomes malicious later, then either it is one of those really, really big providers like Google, and DNS tunnels are not really the biggest problem that we have, or it becomes malicious and it keeps sending the similar kind of queries that it was sending before, so it mimics benign traffic, and we remain ignorant of the problem. And finally, it doesn't mimic benign traffic. It exposes itself to signature-based detection, and we can detect it and handle the incident. Our detection procedure has only two parameters. One for the information bound, 4K bytes in our case, and time resolution, 10 milliseconds. The chart on the left shows that most of the alerts are due to timing for this particular data set. Three times fewer alerts due to query names, and a negligible portion of alerts due to query types. The chart on the right shows that the combined number of alerts hardly depends on our time resolution. Even if we change it by a factor of 100, the number of alerts changes by less than a factor of 2. So that's not really a sensitive parameter. The detection threshold is, of course, much more sensitive, and the number of alerts is roughly inversely proportional to the information bound. If we drop it to 1 kilobyte of information per day, we would have 2 alerts per week per day instead of 2 alerts per week. It would still be manageable, but it would be more work. So at the end, I proudly present our grand result. It broken down by the kind of site that we're looking at and by the category of alert. On the left-hand side, we have results for the three data sets that have information about individual client queries. This is the target environment that we're working for. enterprise network with individual client information. On the right-hand side, we have aggregate query streams. They tell us about the different environments where your network sensor is on the perimeter. For example, UCB in China show what kind of alert rates you would get in an enterprise if you were to aggregate out the client details, no longer see the individual clients. The numbers would still be manageable, but it would be bigger. SIE is a completely different set. This was analyzed with a simplified version of the detection procedure, and this is where all the tunnels are, mostly. The two tunnels in the LBL dataset turned out to be from system administrators who had configured the systems to evade Wi-Fi paywalls. It's a popular application of DNS tunnels, and they forgot to turn it off. I mean, it works well enough that you don't immediately notice that it's there. We have a large number of benign alerts. Those, of course, take the most work. Some malware misconfiguration is clients that are just asking questions to the wrong name server, that are confused, or clients that do all kinds of other things that you get to see when you look at DNS network traffic at scale. You see all kinds of weird stuff. Unknown reflects the limitations of the analyst resources. In some cases, by the time we developed our detection procedure, the domain no longer existed, or the domain redirects to a different site. It's like going to your hometown and you discover that every time some shops have changed ownership. And in other cases, we could rely on other sources. But we couldn't always determine whether a domain was malicious or not. So that's it. Concluding my talk, we have a novel procedure to measure the information content of DNS query streams. We have 1 to 2 alerts per week for enterprise scale networks with a 4 kilobyte information threshold per local client and remote domain. We use lossless compression and other techniques to avoid introducing false negatives. And we have 59 confirmed DNS tunnels in 230 billion queries, all of those tunnels of the same type. That's it. Thank you.
Hi, a quick question. The data sets that you mentioned, are they available for other people to investigate, or are they proprietary?
Could you say, is the software available?
No, the data sets.
The data sets, I don't think so. So this was a collaboration between Berkeley, IBM. We shared the tools, we shared the results, but we didn't share the data sets. Anonymizing that would be a pretty big effort.
Hi, I was wondering if you've tested with something like DNS Curve and how encrypted DNS queries are affected by the 4 kilobyte per day threshold. For instance, suppose you're tunneling all of your local DNS queries over an encrypted DNS inside of DNS tunnel, if this would trigger your alerts.
Yes, the measurements that I did here were all involving encrypted or compressed files. So that would definitely be detected. It's just the amount of information, whether it's in the name or in the timing or the query type or some combination of all of the above, it would show up it would be registered as this amount of information.
I was curious about the 10 kilobyte threshold for the aggregate. So how did you, on what basis did you choose that one? Slide 24.
Yeah. So when you look at individual client queries, so one client goes to google.com, another client goes to something else, the numbers are smaller when you see individual client queries. When you look at the aggregated stream, you're looking at the output from a DNS resolver, basically, and you're seeing all the queries from the clients behind it. And in that case, the amount of information that is sent out is much larger. So the reason for using 10 kilobytes was, given that the amount is so much larger, we raised the detection bound to keep the amount of work for ourselves, the analyst, reasonable.
No, I understand it needs to go up, but I was just curious how you actually ended up with the 10. Because for the 4 you explained, I think that you observed in practice what was happening. I think you said that in one of the earlier slides, right? I mean, was it just a guess? I mean, you tried a few numbers and then 10 seemed to work?
We tried to get the numbers as low as we could. And 4 was definitely a reasonable bound that we ended up with. For the aggregated streams, that just wouldn't work. It would just take too much time to analyze all the events. It wouldn't make sense. But it still gives an idea of what you can detect in the case that your sensor is on the outside of a network instead of inside.
Thank you.